For too long, the fertility market has been bewildering, overwhelming, and frankly, I think has downright ignored the needs and difficult experiences of the people they're supposed to be serving. Ovum has made it their mission to change this completely. Now, I am extremely choosy about who I promote on this podcast because I'm very protective of my listeners and audience, which is why you've probably only ever heard one spoken ad like this before. So it's with complete confidence, excitement, and pride that I can share this amazing company with you. Ovum care about you, truly. From creating products to support conception and fertility that are designed by doctors and backed by the latest science without cutting any corners, from adding access to meditations I've personally written and recorded inside their pregnancy test boxes, Ovum is founded by individuals who've navigated infertility themselves. I really couldn't be more proud to partner with them and tell you about them. Ovum is driven by the belief that everyone who is trying to conceive deserves better, and I am 100% behind this ethos. So head over to startwithovum.com and use code LIFERAFT10 for 10% off their tests and supplements.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What my mission is with the education is to just give men and women the information to make sure they know, because we're never taught this.
Hello and welcome to Fertility Life Raft with me, Alice Rose. This podcast is for you if you find yourself longing for a baby and then finding that the path to bringing them home is not easy. It's for you if you've had enough of feeling like you're losing sight of yourself, because that's how I felt too. And it's also for you if you're supporting someone going through this and want to understand a little bit more. So, welcome to a totally safe space, honest conversation, real and raw stories shared, and a little bit of topical stuff too, because I really believe it's not all down to you to get through this. The world needs to catch up too. Well, hello everybody. How are you? I've had some absolutely lovely messages from some of you wonderful listeners recently. So can I just please say thank you to every single person who listens, whether or not you message me to let me know or leave a review or whatever your relationship with this little podcast is, whether you've listened to every single episode or you've just, this is your first one. I really just want to take a minute to say thank you so much. I'm recording this and it's in my little garden office and it's getting dark here in the UK. It's beginning of September, the seasons are changing. It's actually a difficult time of year for a lot of people on this journey when they see lots of parents sharing photos of children starting school or going back to school. And, you know, there might be triggering language like, oh, thank goodness it's the end of the summer holidays, or finally getting rid of them, or something like that. And I know that and even if there isn't things like that are said, even if it's, you know, just a picture, it can really be quite a difficult time. So if you're listening to this, you know, in real time, then just protect yourself, take it easy, know you're not alone, you're really not. And every time I share anything about this on Instagram or on the podcast or wherever, just know that there is a real community, a global, huge community of people who are with you and who understand. And there's also lots that you can do to build your resilience and to build your ability to manage the hugely emotional trauma that going through this can be. So please do, before I go any further with this episode, please do pop over to my website, thisisalicerose.com, have a look at some of the meditations and courses that I have. And please do also subscribe to my email list, because I'll tell you for why. I have just recently been taking a bit of a hiatus from Instagram, which is kind of my main communication channel, really, apart from this, obviously. And what I've realised is that watching somebody I know have their Instagram account hacked recently, and they've completely lost it, I thought that is just so sad, and I would hate to lose, you know, so many of you who I know have found me through Instagram and are part of that community. So please do go and subscribe to my email list, because that is one way that I know I'm not going to lose you. And I promise I will not bombard you with emails. I don't have, I'm not very good like that. I occasionally might send like a few about a certain course that I might be launching or an offer that I'm doing, but they're quite few and far between. So please don't worry about that. Anyway, gosh, wasn't planning to ramble on about that. The other thing to say is that this podcast is very, I have a wonderful person who helps me put it together called Jordan, and she is great. And but it is quite unproduced in lots of ways. And I think that is working for us. and at the moment, that's where we're going with it. I just really love being completely authentic with you, and just, yeah, I like to just, yeah, use this space as a way to speak to you directly. Anyway, I've just checked the time and I've been talking for 3.5 minutes, so I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna let you listen to my guest this week. Now, I have a real mix of guests on this show, as you know. I really like to hear from, you know, just real life people who are just going through this, who I feel like have a real story to share that could be helpful for somebody else. Or I love speaking to other coaches or advocates who are making big changes in the fertility world, like either through helping people one-to-one, or, you know, like Amber Itzo's Fight for IVF campaign, or, you know, there are so many people who are so passionate in this field. And I think it's really great to have like a massive cross-section of people that we're talking to. And I also think that I think it's important to sometimes, you know, recognize that a part of this is just absorbing information. You know, like when I started going through all of our fertility stuff, it felt like I needed a degree suddenly in a whole new world, and it felt at times absolutely overwhelming. And I didn't know what to believe. I didn't know, you know, who was legit, who wasn't. So what I also tried to do with this podcast and all my stuff is to talk to people who are, you know, really at the top of their fields, who really know what they're talking about, and just try to ask from a patient's perspective for them to kind of share what they know, because I think that can be so helpful. What I also feel is important to say is that, you know, sometimes it can be hard to hear the truth or the, you know, the science behind all of this, because sometimes it's not what we want to hear. But I feel like what we also need to see and recognize is to go, listen, I can take on all the knowledge, and I can get really empowered with that, and I can understand it to the best of my ability. It doesn't mean I have to let it dictate my life. It doesn't have to mean that I have to, you know, give up any belief in my own scenario. That is down to you. That's about taking ownership over your own journey. So I just want to say that before we, you know, dive into this interview. Not that it's like a really scary interview by any means. It's actually a really brilliant interview with a woman who really knows her stuff and who's been through it herself. So that's another reason why I really wanted to speak to, let me introduce her properly, Professor Joyce Harper. So Joyce is brilliant, first of all. She and I have worked on a few things together. Me, obviously, as a you know, offering the patient perspective for various kind of conferences and things like that. And Joyce as a professional, healthcare professional. She is a professor of reproductive science at the Institute for Women's Health at the University College London. She is a director of education at the IFWH and head of the Reproductive Science and Society Group. She's worked in the fields of fertility, genetics, reproductive health and women's health for over 30 years. And she's really passionate, particularly passionate about education and discussion of all aspects of women's health. And she's also the mother of 3 sons born through IVF. So we talk a little bit about her story in a minute, and you'll hear about how it impacted her and what that was like working as a professional in the field, going through it, and how it still impacts her work now. having that knowledge, that insider knowledge and empathy. And I really love Joyce's way of, you know, talking about this stuff. She is so passionate. She's brilliant. She's really good fun as well. So I hope you love this interview. Do let us know if you do. I'm going to stop talking. It's been 7.5 minutes. I think that might be my longest intro ever. I do hope you forgive me for that. And please enjoy the wonderful Professor Joyce Harper.
Welcome, Professor Joyce Harper, to the Fertility Life Raft podcast. It's such an honour to have you. Thank you so much for your time today.
It's a real pleasure. Absolutely, Alice. Real pleasure.
Thank you. So we were just chatting just before then, and it's quite a hot day here, actually. So we're both sitting here sweating a little bit. And I really wanted to talk to you, Joyce, because not only are you so experienced in this field as a medical professional, but you also went through your own fertility journey. And not only that, I know what a passionate and brilliant and positive speaker you are in this whole space. So that's why I really wanted to have you on this podcast. So first of all, I'd love to hear a bit more about your personal story, if you're happy to share that.
Yeah, certainly. So I'd always wanted to have kids at around the age of 30. And actually, we're just in the process of doing various surveys to ask people a number of questions about their attitudes to having children. And one of them is, what's your ideal age? It may even be an age in the past. And even now, so many people are writing age 30. I think it's one of those sort of golden ages where people have normally, you know, maybe studied or got their career on the go and got married and bought a house. And so it's really interesting that even all these years later, it's still age 30. But I was in a long-term relationship and he wasn't ready. A very common story that we hear women say, he wasn't quite ready. And I think for many years, I thought, well, maybe I don't want children. Maybe I don't want children. That wasn't true. I did want children. But you know, what do you do when you're in this relationship? Do you end it and then try and look for someone to have children? It's really difficult. Anyway, we did split up when I was 32. And then again, I had a relationship with someone who also wasn't ready. He was much younger than me. And then at 35, I have a cartoon on my slides like this. OMG, I forgot to have kids. And I'm like, that almost happened to me. And I'm working in the fertility field. And there was me in this situation. So I really did at 35 go out all hour and talk to try and find someone who's straight away the father of my children. I said on the first date, if you don't want children, let's stop now. But we decided not to use any contraception. Months went past. I obviously knew a lot about the fertile window. I knew when I was ovulating, when was the best time, and nothing happened. So then started the various fertility tests. And even though I'd been a clinical embryologist for many years, so I'd worked in the lab helping those going through IVF to help their embryos along, and helped many thousands of women get pregnant. I really had wanted to do this naturally. And I think that's a normal response. And then we started, nothing was happening. So we started on the snowball effect of fertility treatment, intrauterine insemination, egg collections, frozen transfers, etc. And this went on for many years, lots of tears, lots of huge trauma, a very painful journey and I know anyone who's ended up on this journey. And eventually I delivered my first child just before my 40th birthday. So that was not plan A at all. And then had a few more years and was just really lucky with frozen embryos to have twins at 42. And I know from the IVF data, you know, I was right on the edge of the age effect and the success of that. So it was about 7 years in all to have my children. And I just really understand what women and men go through, anyone going through this journey has to deal with, and all the ups and downs along the way. And I really don't want anyone to have to go through that. So anyway, we'll talk about other things, but that's where, how I really felt that I'm many people that go through a really negative situation want to turn it around to a positive one. And I really wanted to turn this round to a positive experience and share my story with others and help give information to people so that they can make informed choices about their fertility, and not, as we often hear people say, I wish I'd known this when I was younger. Why didn't I know this? And that's a common occurrence, and we don't want people to do that.
Oh my God, so much to say there, Joyce. Thank you for sharing all of that with me. And I knew it was I knew you'd had a long fertility journey, as we all call it. Really interesting that still people are saying that age 30 is the kind of, in their minds, like the ideal age that they would have kids. And it was interesting that you then followed that up saying, I guess it's because, you know, by that stage, you've kind of got your, you know, in theory, you've got your career on track, you've kind of found your life partner, et cetera, et cetera, in theory. And actually, when it comes down to it, exactly as you experience and as I've experienced in different ways, life goes on its own little path, doesn't it? So let's talk about that kind of ideal age, and then in relation to your passion, which is education and understanding, actually, you know, because we'll come on to it and talk in great detail about it, because you've got your new book, which is Your Fertile Years, haven't you? So speaking about that kind of ideal age, and obviously you had, I mean, yeah, so that's amazing. So you actually decided, I need to go and have my kids now. I am going to end this relationship, and I need to go and find the father of my children. That's amazingly proactive.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, and lots of women I know are in that situation. And one of the surveys we did ask women what factors are affecting their decision to have children. And unfortunately, there are women who replied there and said, my partner's not ready. And I absolutely know how that feels. And I've heard many women say, well, what do I do? And it's very tricky. And I even did consider solo motherhood. And back then, that was, how old am I? That was a long time ago. I'm 58. Do the math.
Are you really? God, you look absolutely amazing, Joyce. I'm going to ask you what your secret is, your youthful looks.
I've got some secrets. I'm happy to share them. I, you know, then I didn't really know anyone that had done that. But I would have done it. I definitely would have done it. I'm really glad now that women are finding that journey easier to go down that solo motherhood route. And I know many, many people that have done it, and they've had great happiness from that and had a wonderful family. So, but I certainly consider, I asked two of my male friends if they donate, and you know, there were discussions going on. But yeah, it's a really tricky decision for women. And you mentioned the age, and I know it's really controversial that there are some people that feel that us fertility specialists saying to women, you know, you've got a biological clock, but we're disempowering women and telling them things that aren't true. But I've worked in this field for over 30 years, and I've seen all the data from natural conception through fertility treatment, egg donation, etc. And as a scientist, I really always critique any scientific data that I see, and I analyze it, and I decide whether I think it's robust. And I really, truly believe that, unfortunately, especially around the age of 35, the majority of women's fertility will start to decline. And obviously you'll see women get pregnant in their early 40s. The latest data from the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority for IVF actually was a little bit more encouraging for those women in their early 40s than it had been previously, but it's still a tiny percent. So around the age of 44, it's like 2% chance of getting pregnant by IVF, or 2.5 maybe. So what my mission is with the education is to just give men and women the information, to make sure they know, because we're never taught this. Yeah. You're taught at school how not to get pregnant and how not to get a sexually transmitted infection. You are not taught how to have a healthy pregnancy, how to check your fertility, and how to get pregnant. And unfortunately at school, and we're doing a survey of teenagers at the moment, you know, at school, they tell you, you can get pregnant at any time in your menstrual cycle, because they don't want teenagers to get pregnant. And that's not quite true. You can't get pregnant any time of your menstrual cycle. You can get pregnant for 24 hours when you ovulate. So what we are taught at school is not quite right. So in our survey, we have asked for people's knowledge, and a small proportion, but some people do feel that you can get pregnant at any time because that's what they were taught.
Yeah.
So I'm not telling anyone what to do. Everyone's obviously absolutely individual. What one person wants to do is not what the next person wants to do. I just don't want to hear the comment, but I didn't know that. Nobody taught me this. If I'd have known this earlier, I'd have made different decisions. So it's all about informed decisions. And it's not a huge amount of information we need to tell people. It's not rocket science. I also want women to understand their menstrual cycle just for their own reproductive health. So there are some women that have problems with their menstrual cycle that can, identify polycystic ovaries or endometriosis. So if you were never taught about this, how are you going to know that having a menstrual cycle that's 40 days in between your periods is not right, or having all this pain that you have during your period is not right? So we need to get these conversations on the table, let people know what's normal, let them know that if something's not quite right, they should go and see their doctor and get things checked out. So it's not all about having babies at all. Mm-hmm. And my book's got a lot about having children, but it's certainly not the majority of it. The majority of it is education about reproductive health, so that if you do spot something that's amiss, you can go and get help sooner rather than later.
Oh, it's so important. And you know, this whole conversation around what we are taught and not taught in schools always blows my mind, because I just think, God, yeah, we were not taught this. And I, as someone who always had, you know, wildly irregular cycles, but just kind of thought, oh well, you know, I didn't really think much of it, really. I mean, it was annoying, and I always had quite bad skin, and I always, you know, there were signs that something was amiss with my hormones and with my cycle, and clearly something was not quite right. But it was never really a thing at school. You know, you are taught, you know, 28 day cycle and blah blah blah, and I was like, well, of course no one has a 28 day cycle, you know, that's just silly, whatever. But at the same time, I just think I don't know, like, because it wasn't a conversation, it never really occurred to me to do anything about it until it was time. And then I was like, oh, now I need to learn about my menstrual cycle. And, you know, even having that conversation about your menstrual cycle, you know, saying those words, talking about menstruation, talking about reproductive health, talking about periods even, is still a stigma. What is going on there?
Oh, it drives me mad. I think things have got a little bit better. There's a number of documentaries and things on now. It's in magazines. We talk about these things in the media quite a bit. But then there's also lots of misinformation out there. So there's many of us on a campaign to try and get this normalized, so that people have the information, they have the support, they know when they need to go and have checks. And, one thing, when a woman gets pregnant, that first 12 weeks, that this secret, we mustn't tell anyone. And it's always upset me, because I think if anything does go wrong, surely you want your friends and family to support you. But so many people, it's really the norm to just keep it a secret and not tell anyone, because people feel embarrassed to broach these subjects, even with close friends and family. So I really want us to get out there. And I mean, luckily now we're saying the word vagina and vulva. You know, before those words, right, you can't say those words. And some people have told me I tried to put a post on Instagram and it blocked it because I mentioned sex education. So even now, still, there's some words that, you know, people are like, oh, you mustn't say that word in public, and which is ridiculous. So I think we do need to start young. I think parents should use the right words for our genitalia to our children. And, you know, you don't have to tell them everything at, you know, age five, for example. But, you know, why not use the word penis and vagina and vulva? And then as they ask questions and get to know their bodies, they can understand those things. And it then makes it more normal, not sort of a hush-hush thing that we're discussing behind closed doors. So I'm just really happy that things have improved in the last 30 years and we are having those conversations. There's lots of films and things about people going through IVF. You know, it's really interesting that those things are happening. So we're getting there, but I think we need to speed things up so that people can have support. Friends and family are there for us when things go wrong, and we really need to have people to talk to if things are tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm interested to hear as well, as you were going through all of your treatment and going through your own heartache and all of the emotional turmoil that we know happens when we try to make a baby and it's not easy, what was that like working as a professional in the field at the time?
It was a nightmare. There was one day I had a fail cycle and I just burst out crying. And the embryologist, who's a long-term friend of mine, said, well, why are you crying? I just ran out of the clinic. And, the whole drug regimes and everything, so emotional. And then failing and having another negative test, that's the worst thing. So, yeah, it's not good to go through treatment at work. It was really, really difficult. But then lovely that I'm eternally grateful to them. And one thing I wanted to discuss is the cost of treatment. It's ridiculously expensive. And I was I'm on an academic wage where we get paid really nothing. I would never have been able to afford my treatment. And I was incredibly privileged to not have to pay for it. I paid for the drugs. I live in Essex and we had no funding for IVF. So I really feel for those couples, and I've got some relatives, close relatives, who don't have enough money to go through IVF and they're in a place that's not funded. And I just think that's so sad. And there's so many countries that I travel to where they fund 3 or 6 cycles and they don't understand what we're doing in the UK. And I know we've got a limited budget, but I think it's so hard for people that can't even try. But I think for many, trying and not succeeding is one thing, but not trying at all is really, really difficult. So again, I've done some studies on childless people who wanted children but didn't, and their stories are really heartbreaking. They have filled their lives with other things and they're happy, but those thoughts of what they've missed has never gone away. So it's really hard.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because it's becoming more and more clear to me that we have this issue where fertility is still not seen under the same banner as other healthcare issues by the government, by the wider society. And there's this weird thing of fertility treatment being seen as a luxury option. And it's the most heartbreaking and upsetting and terrible thing, because the emotional turmoil, as you know, and everything that people go through just to have their family, it's got to get recognized. It's got to get, you know, that it's got to go further up the priority list. But how do we change the government's opinion? I mean, I don't know if you know Amber Itso, but she's doing an amazing job with her Fight for IVF campaign and having, you know, meetings and discussions with different boroughs saying, look, you've got to fund, because there are, as you, yeah, so many boroughs which have absolutely no funding whatsoever. And then what are you supposed to do if you haven't got the money?
Oh, it is unbelievable. And this postcode lottery is just, it's criminal. Why can someone one side of a street get funding and the person on the other side can't? I, I mean, that's a ridiculous system. I'm sure there are other countries that probably work this, but it is incredible. Mm. You know, there are other medical procedures that are done that, you know, you could debate. Someone's told me recently that penile implants in men, very old men, men in their 80s, which costs about 15,000. I don't know if they would ever be refused, but yeah, they are done. I was told, I don't know if it's true, I was told they were done more routinely across the UK than IVF.
Wait, I got to stop you there. My face is like, wait, what?
Someone might complain about this one, but...
Wait a minute. Penile implants for men in their 80s are done on the NHS.
So impotent. So they manage to have an erection before, but now they can't. They're 80. And yeah, so that someone's told me that, a very reliable person's told me that, who I will not name. But if that is true, then yeah, I think we really need to reevaluate people not being able to have a child.
Oh, that little fire in me there.
I'm sure that will bring some comments.
I mean, that is quite shocking. And whole other debate there. I don't know what these men are going through. I'm sure it's very challenging. But I mean, why on earth that would be funded? And that, no. Okay. That's a whole other situation. I would love to get your thoughts on because coming back to funding as well, and coming back to how incredibly frustrating it is not to be able to get funded if you're above the BMI threshold. And if you are doing, I mean, I have had the most heartbreaking conversations with women and men who are truly doing everything in their power. But there is some debate, is there not, over where this threshold has come from, the actual, you know, where BMI itself has originated from and why we use it still. It seems like it's a very outdated way of looking at things. What's your thought on this?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. So I'm 5'1" and a tiny bit. So my BMI, I'm clinically obese, apparently. I exercise every day, so I've still got a rosy face for my Zumba class. I exercise every day, I'm very fit, but I am on the BMI clinically obese. So for sure we know that the if you are obese, there are some issues with fertility. There's also issues with the ongoing health of your children. There's a lot more evidence coming out now about men and women's preconception health. So there's recently a post about alcohol, big studies that have been done. And in my book, I was quite negative about alcohol. I do love to drink, for sure. But there's always some conflicting data, but I have seen reports that drinking red wine a few times a week is going to help your fertility. I think we need to be sensible about these things. I think we need to think, is this really healthy? Is drinking wine really healthy? And I think we'd all say it's lovely, but it's not healthy. So we have to think about our weight for sure. BMI is a nightmare measurement though, and so as far as I did hear that they are going to stop using BMI totally, nothing to do with IVF, just reevaluate the whole system because it is problematic. I'm aware that certainly for women, shorter women, it seems we're all obese and tall men who are big are fine. I'm like, really, has that, you know? So I think I'm afraid there is evidence that if you are seriously overweight, it will affect your fertility. So in my book, in chapter 3, I have said that you're going to certainly increase your chance if you really balance your what I call four pillars of well-being. And one is nutrition, which is also everything. It's nutrition, weight, alcohol, etc. The second is exercise, but moderate exercise, not excessive exercise. Third is sleep. Unfortunately, there are links with infertility and sleep, but we're not sure whether it's cause or effect. So when you're going through infertility treatment and you're stressed, you're not going to sleep so well. And it's sort of a vicious circle. And then the fourth is your overall mental health and well-being. Just, you know, that we do have people say, oh, just relax and you'll get pregnant, which is obviously not, you know, it's rubbish. But the whole research around stress and fertility is, again, very difficult to come to a clear conclusion. So we do have all of these studies with all of this information, and people are bombarded with, should I do this? Should I do that? You know, mustn't exercise too much, but I must exercise a bit. And so I just want people to be sensible about their preconception health. But I don't think it's just preconception. I think it's lifelong. So when you're a teenager, you need to think about your health. And also menopausal women. So many women experience major issues around the menopause. The first thing that many of us would say was, are you balancing your four pillars of well-being? Are you drinking wine every night? Are you drinking lots of caffeine? Are you not exercising at all? So these rules, for me, apply through our whole reproductive life forever. And I think we should have everything in moderation. So trying to sort out our weight is unfortunately important, but not excessively so. So unless you were really, really overweight, we'd have to be careful. But I think getting yourself to a good weight before you get pregnant anyway is a good idea. But certainly there are links with being overweight and your ovulation, chances of getting pregnant and carrying a successful pregnancy.
Okay. All right. And to people listening who are kind of going, oh my God, I need to do X, Y, and Z and feeling a bit panicky, I think also it's really important to say as well, as you just mentioned, those four pillars again. So actually how imperative it is that we look after our mental health while we're going through all of this. And obviously, I mean, that's where I'm most interested personally, is that emotional mindset, well-being, which can be profoundly, you know, radically transformative when we really go into that. But I think, you know, what I love about you, Joyce, is that you don't shy away from saying, look, this is the data. You take from it what you need to take. And what I think is helpful to remind people, as well as looking at the data, everything is so individual as well. Yes. And, you know, so yes, look at the data. Yes, have that information and then go away and have a cup of tea and go for a walk and just remember that you are okay and whole and perfect as you are, like whatever else, you know, the world is telling you. And as you were saying before, you know, we are bombarded, aren't we, with information at every turn. So how can we take in the information in a really empowered way that and so we don't end up feeling, you know, sort of unable to take it in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, honestly, I feel IVF patients, well, fertility, infertile patients more than ever are bombarded. And listen, I'm someone who's always struggled with my weight. My whole life I've been up and down, normally overweight. So I absolutely know it's really hard. So I think what you've said as well about being individual, this is something I say all the time. We are all totally individual. So what applies to one person will not apply to you. And what anyone needs to do, both individually and then as a couple, is take it all in and decide what's right for you. And that's what's really important. So, you know, you'll see, oh, take this supplement or do yoga or have reflexology or whatever, and then someone will say, oh, it worked for them. But just our building blocks of our body and what we're deficient in, what we've got excess in, our muscle structure, our heart, everything, we're so different that we don't have one size fits all. And so you know, one person might be deficient in vitamin D but not the next person, and you won't know unless you have all of these hundreds of tests, which you're not going to do. So I just think, you know, try things, but don't try to be overwhelmed by it. Just read things, take things in and think sensibly, what actually fits for me and what do I think? Oh, I might try that or I might not. So it is very, very individual. And yeah, there's no magic diet, there's no magic supplement. In my view, You know, I tried acupuncture, I tried reflexology, I tried everything when I was trying to get pregnant. You've just got to do what you feel comfortable with, but there is nothing magic that's going to say if everyone does this, they will all get pregnant. It just doesn't work like that. We're just too varied and too individual.
And is there, because obviously we have such a big proportion of people who fall into the unexplained category, unexplained infertility. And there does seem to be so much that we still don't know about this area of medicine. So where are we with that? Because I know, it's been 40 odd years now, hasn't it? Since Louise Brown, that's her name, isn't it? Yeah. Louise was born. And how far have we come since then, and where are we going?
Well, if we just look at IVF, for example, the latest data from the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority is showing that for most ages, we're 3 times more successful than we were back in the 90s when they started to collect the data. So treatments are definitely improving. There's more treatments that we can offer. We've now got ICSI for male infertility. We didn't have that back in the 80s. We've got frozen embryo transfers, we've got freezing eggs. So there's a lot of tech that's happening. As far as the advice we offer to someone trying to get pregnant, as I said, there's nothing really that we would say. There's no magic pill or potion that will help. We've just got to be sensible, and we are a natural phenomena. So we've got to treat that naturally and look after that. So yeah, on the techniques, we've really improved. The unknown infertility is, in many ways, it has shrunk a little. We do know a lot more. There's more tests we can do. We can find out a lot more. But at the moment, there's still a big chunk of people where we just don't know. I did, for International Women's Day, we did a discussion on race and reproduction. And one of our brilliant consultants at UCH, she had lots of fertility treatment, didn't get pregnant, had egg donation, had a baby, and then got pregnant naturally.
Wow.
And you hear these stories.
Dude.
This is one of our consultants who this absolutely happened to. So, that was really close to home to hear her tell her story. So, these things can still happen. Unknown infertility is a really difficult one.
I think it's so frustrating for people. And I think, like, when you have the diagnosis, there's often that sense of relief, isn't there? That go, okay, at least I know what's wrong. Now I can attempt, at least do something to see if I can make it better. What is your advice for people who are, I guess, at the start of, okay, they go, okay, I'm gonna have a baby now, and they start trying. The technical advice is try for a year. Is that right? Before you go and get seen?
Yeah, absolutely. So my advice would be, first, even before this, to whether you want children or not, just as I've said, to be really aware of your menstrual cycle. And if you're around about 28 days ish, sort of, anything from sort of 22 to 30 odd is fine. And if it's pretty regular and you feel everything's okay, then that's a good position. If you haven't got those characteristics and you're worried about anything, I would go and see someone sooner rather than later, even if you don't want children, just to see if there's anything wrong that needs treatment. But if you do want children, that's really important. Then the preconception health's really important. So before you start trying, just think, are we doing those things, exercising, not smoking, moderate drinking, etc. Just to get those. I don't think you need, I heard someone the other day who was 39 say, I'm going to wait a year while I sort out my preconception health. And I said, no, don't, 39, no, just go try now and get pregnant. Yeah, I don't think you need to spend a year optimizing your health, of course, just do what's right for you. So then when you're ready to start trying, I think it's really important to know roughly when you're ovulating. And some people say this can be stressful, but if you want to, the really easy way to check is ovulation sticks. You can get them from Amazon. You just wee on them around the time you think you might be ovulating, and it will tell you whether you're ovulating. And to have intercourse around that time is the best. You may just want to do nothing and just be totally natural for a while, but that's just checking you're having sex at the right time. And then if you're under 35, about 90%, we've just done a study with Natural Cycles looking at people who are using their app for getting pregnant, and 90% were pregnant within a year. Actually, most will be pregnant within 6 months, but within a year, 90%. So if you're under 35 and you're in that 10% that hasn't got pregnant after a year, then you do need to get things moving. But if you're 35, you should only try for about 6 months. So that was me. I tried for 6 months, knew I was ovulating. Things didn't happen, and we started to test within about 6 months. Mm. So then you'd have your hormones checked, sperm check, tubes checked, etc. Because I know some people like to say this is not true, but honestly, all of the data I've ever looked at, age 35, things really start to go down between 35 and about 42, and over your early 40s, trying to get pregnant is really tricky and really, really unlikely with fertility treatment. So if you think you're going to go through the fertility treatment route, you really have to be, you know, really under 38. And if we look at the figures from the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, and the same thing in the US, what they do is they group pregnancy, live birth, they don't look at pregnant, live birth rate. So did you have a child? I do it as 35 and under, because under that age, whether you're 28 or 32 is really about the same. And then almost every country will do it in 2 year batches. And if you look at the data, your chance of a live birth goes down, 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 down. And at 42 onwards, it's really, really tiny. It's just a little slither on the graph. And you can have a look at this data on the HFEA's website. So if you arrive at the fertility clinic age 40, it's really, really difficult. And the chance of you getting pregnant with your own egg, if you use a donor egg, all the donors are under 35, you have an equal chance of getting pregnant at any age with a donor egg. But with your own egg, the chance over 42 is very, very low. Over 44, it's almost non-existent.
Mm. Okay. All right. I want to go back to, I was really interested when you were sharing your story and you were saying that there was that day where you had that negative test and you cried because you're a human being going through something really hard. And the professional next to you, the embryologist, I think you said, could not compute what was going on. So where's that disconnect coming? And how easy is it for you now as a medical professional to remember that and to keep that sense of, you know, professionalism and empathy at the same time?
You remember when you've gone through these things, you never forget them. There's so many things. I cried a lot. I really, really cried a lot. I do feel I'm still traumatized from it. I cry about it now. Actually, the day we did the International Women's Day event, you know, I was crying. It never goes away from you, I don't think. But I think in any branch of medicine, I think that until you've been through something yourself, you'd never know what it's like to be the other side of the table. But does every health professional need to, you know, have gone through something? I mean, obviously, that's just not possible, and I'm probably not necessary. But, you know, they often say that the best counsellor for example, alcoholism or any addiction is someone who's already been through it. They will definitely have a very different perspective than someone who's been through it. So you never realise. I never realised. As I said, I've worked in the field since 1987, and I never realised how traumatic it was. And I totally sympathise with anybody. And with the fertility education that we're doing, because we've set up a UK and an international group, our motto is to work on prevention. And we won't prevent every type of infertility. We won't prevent every person ever visiting an IVF unit, but we do feel that some of it can be prevented by some of the things that I've talked about today. So I'm pretty sure if I'd have tried to get pregnant at 28 naturally, I would have got pregnant. But once I was 35, I knew things were going to be difficult.
So actually, it's not, you know, and I agree, we don't need to have been through something in order to understand or have an understanding. Actually, what we need is also better education for medical professionals working in the field about what the trauma that people are experiencing and the emotional impact of what people are going through is like. Because I think if there was some wider knowledge about that, and I think it is improving because of what's happening with social media and Instagram and people sharing their stories much more publicly and much more confidently a lot of the time, it's improving, but there's still a bit of a disconnect sometimes between the medical professional and the patient sitting in front of them.
Disconnect's the right word. Even for me, when you see a medical professional, they talk about their bedside manner, and even for me, some of my friends, their bedside manner was really abrupt. And I thought, well, they're just being like that because it's me, or is that what they're normally like? But then I've spoken to many patients since. And some people can be very unsympathetic. Especially, I think one of the worst situations is a failed cycle or a miscarriage. And we had a discussion recently about miscarriage and some of the things that women had been told. By a nurse, someone was told, well, that's God telling you that you shouldn't be a mother. And this was recently, they're all individual as well. Anyone that treats, anyone in the health professional, in the health profession is an individual. But yeah, I totally agree. We have to work on education. And I'm sure many people that have been through IVF will tell you what one doctor tells them. In the same clinic, they have different advice from a different doctor in the same clinic. And we recently did interviews with medical directors, IVF medical directors, about IVF add-ons. And they all have different views. And they're allowed to have different views. But we are all individual on as a professional as well. And how, as I said, how I interpret data, I have to say that's how I've interpreted. There'll be another scientist somewhere who's interpreted totally different. And with the use of some of these add-ons, for example, that is the case. There's some people that don't agree. And one thing we do a lot at conferences is we have debates, and they're always really exciting. But it's not difficult to find two health professionals who have a totally opposite view of any treatment, not just fertility. Lots and lots of things, menopause treatment. It's a big debate. I was in a discussion yesterday with someone. Should we give all women HRT or should we not? There's totally different camps. So what that's telling us is, going back to the individual, we are all individual and we don't have one size fits all for anything.
And that I also think is that there lies the problem in a lot of cases, because I think as a patient, and speaking from my own experience, by the time I got to the fertility clinic, I was sort of like, right, brilliant, tell me what to do and I'll do it. But there was different opinions, and then I was told I was going to do one thing, and then the consultant said one thing, and the nurse said, well, why is she telling you to do that? And I was like, oh, what? So like, surely and it's so confusing as the patient to begin to understand that actually even within your clinic there might be disagreements about your treatment. So even more important to empower the patient with not just information, but also, again, coming back to emotional resilience and emotional intelligence and understanding, right, what is happening here? Oh, I'm being bombarded, or, oh God, I feel uneasy about this. What can I do to give myself some strength here so that I can then go away and make the decision myself, if that's what it comes down to, or speak up and ask, well, what are you disagreeing about? What can I do? Like, it's so important for everyone to advocate for themselves as they go through their journey, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so I absolutely agree. It's very, very difficult for anybody to go through this because there's not one answer. So, you know, I'll say again, we're all individual, take in what you can, be aware that people are going to have different views and decide what's best for you. And that, so there's, you can't do anything majorly wrong. It's very individual. I mean, just thinking of the journey of fertility, there'll be some people who will decide, I don't want to have any tests. We'll just try. If we don't get pregnant, we don't get pregnant. Some people will go all the way to a surrogate. So different people will have different views about what's right for them. And yeah, you are going to get two doctors telling you different things in the same clinic.
Oh my goodness. Well, I could talk to you all day, Joyce, but I'm aware I don't want to take up any more of your time. So I just want to say thank you so much. Your book is out now, isn't it?
Yes, there's a copy here. Da, da, da. So yeah, it's out now. So, and I really want to talk to people about it. So I know we're not quite open up with the COVID situation yet, but yeah, I'd love to come talk to small women's groups, big groups of people, whatever, and to hear different views. I know not everyone's going to agree with my interpretation. And I really want to hear other people's views and thoughts and to see how we can deliver these messages. We certainly know, because I've helped found the UK Fertility Education Initiative in 2016. And last year we formed the International Committee. And what we're trying to do is develop tailored fertility education. So we know that what we tell an 18-year-old boy and what we tell a 40-year-old woman who's trying to get pregnant, the way we tell them, certainly, and the tools we use to tell them are going to be very different. So this is what we're working on. This is sort of the next 10 years work for me now to see how we can best give people the right information without being too controversial and do it in a sensitive way so that we feel that we've empowered them with that knowledge so they can decide what they want to do. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Joyce. And go and find Joyce's book, which is Your Fertile Years by Professor Joyce Harper, in all good bookshops, I imagine, and online and wherever you can find it. And where can people find you if they want to connect with you further, Joyce?
So I have a website called joyceharper.com and my contact's there. And please get in touch. And I'd love to be let out of my lounge. I'm a people person, so I really am missing interaction with people, and I love teaching, so I'd love to hopefully this year travel the country and talk to groups of people about what we've talked about and hear their points of view. I'd really, really love to. So please get in contact, and I'd love to come and do book clubs, chats, etc.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Alice.
Professor Joyce, thank you so, so much for your time, for your work, for your passion, for your education. We desperately do need more education on women's health and more information for everyone. Reproductive health as well, not just women's health, of course. And yes, I really love what she was saying as well there about that the next 10 years work is to see how we can best give the right information without being too controversial and do it in a sensitive way so we can feel like we've empowered people so that people can decide what they want to do. Yes, exactly that. Empower yourself with knowledge. Try not to get overwhelmed by it. Please get in touch if you have anything that you want to ask Joyce or that you that has come up for you when you've been listening to this. I would love to get some to hear from you. And as always, do go and leave me a review. I'm really proud of how many this little podcast has, it's really amazing, and that's all you. And I can't tell you enough times like how important it is for my work. So do please do go and leave an Apple review. And if you can't do that for any reason, then feel free to drop me a line on Instagram, or you can email me at alice@thisisalicerose.com. So I'm going to love you very much and leave you. I know how hard this journey is. Do you know what? I do want to say as well, just before I sign off, you probably know that I run a membership, which opens every now and then. At the moment it's closed, but we have a very active and beautifully supportive online group. And there's a lot of people in that group right now who are really exhausted by all of this. And if that's you today, yeah, I just want to say we understand. It can be exhausting. It really can be. And I'd love for you to just consider what do you need when you're tired? You know, you need rest. You need rest. So just always ask yourself, what do I need? What do I need? What do I need? And when you're exhausted, you need some rest. So whatever that looks like for you, whether it is actually a break from all of this, or whether it's just, you know, maybe it's just an evening of a bit of self-care, or whatever it is, be mindful, be conscious of where you're at, and try not to just plow through, because you will burn out with it all. So lots of self-compassion, lots of self-care, please, and just take care, and I'll see you soon.